from the Atlantic to the Pacific, across the islands of the Caribbean, from mountain crest to mountain crest, from canyons to the clouds and into the cosmos, we're pumping wattage high and low, plus streaming worldwide on the internet and keeping you company tonight. It's the place to relax and hang out. I'm your host, Joshua P. Warren, and this is Speaking of Strange, giving you the latest and discussing the weirdest. We have assembled the finest team of reporters and the most intriguing guests, and that's why we are your favorite hub in a wild world. So keep it tuned right here. If you are just now tuning in, well, okay, this is the last Speaking of Strange before the 4th of July. And so I have some information, some material to present to you this hour that I find rather intriguing, and I often touch on this kind of content around the 4th of July. It's about the idea that the United States of America prevailed against all odds and continues to persist as the most powerful country in the world, based partly upon divine intervention. And I have a lot of material here. I'm not sure how much of it will make it through, so let me get right to it. And let's just start with something that's a little bit more recent that I think all of you listening can relate to. Let's start with George H.W. Bush. Now, we're not talking about George W. We're talking about his father, George Herbert Walker Bush, who was the vice president under Reagan before he became president himself. You may know that he was an ace pilot in World War II. And on August 1st of 1944, George H.W. Bush, who was then only in his 20s, he was very young, he piloted one of four Avenger aircraft that attacked some Japanese installations. He was promoted, and the actual event happened on September 2nd. So during the attack, he and the other Avengers encountered intense anti-aircraft fire. Bush's aircraft was hit and his engine caught on fire. Despite his plane being on fire, Bush completed his attack and released bombs over his target, scoring several damaging hits. And with his engine ablaze, he flew several miles and then he ejected. The other man in the plane ejected, but his parachute did not open, and I believe he died. The other Avenger pilots also died. On the other hand, George H.W. Bush parachuted down into the ocean. So here he is by himself in the middle of nowhere in the scorching Pacific sun in some of the most dangerous shark-infested waters in the world, floating there helplessly for 4 hours until finally he was located and a submarine came to rescue him. In fact, there is, amazingly enough, even film footage of George H.W. Bush being pulled out of the water. And if he had died that day, well, of course, he would have been one of the millions of casualties of World War II, and there's a very good chance that you would never know he even existed. However, because that he did live that day, and you could say against many, many odds, he not only affected the world through his own presidency, but he affected the world through three presidencies. Because, again, he was the vice president under Reagan, and then he became the president, and then, of course, his son, George W. Bush, became the president. So dramatic aspects and episodes in the history of the United States, you could say, hinged upon what happened that day in World War II to this one young man. And it makes you wonder, if he had died that day, would the world have turned out differently, or would the people who ended up being in those positions that he and his offspring occupied, would they have made ultimately the same kinds of decisions? It questions fate and destiny. But the point is here that if you look back throughout U.S. history, you will find again and again episodes of future presidents and even sitting presidents encountering similar harrowing circumstances. In fact, Andrew Jackson was the first sitting U.S. president that an assassination was attempted on. This happened, in 1806. Andrew Jackson had, as a matter of fact, just finished attending a funeral at the U.S. Capitol building, and he was walking by himself, because, mind you, this is before the Secret Service and all that was around. He was just walking by himself across the lawn outside the Capitol building, and a man named Charles Dickinson walked up to him, and this Charles Dickinson guy was he was a disgruntled painter who didn't like, you know, whatever Jackson was doing, and he had two pistols loaded. He pulled his first pistol out, pointed it at Jackson, and fired, but the gun misfired. So he throws it down, he pulls the second pistol out, points it at Jackson, pulls the trigger. The second one misfired. With that, Jackson, Old Hickory, who happened to be carrying a cane, beat this man with his cane personally until he was subdued by other members of Congress and people who happened to be nearby. Now, of course, Andrew Jackson made a profound impact on the country, and some would say he did some great things with, for example, the Treasury and the U.S. debt. A lot of people don't like him, of course, because he initiated the Trail of Tears and relegating the Indians to Oklahoma. But how amazing it was that he was fired upon point blank twice and the guns misfired. Teddy Roosevelt, as you may recall, was shot once while he was about to give a speech. The gunman fired and the bullet actually passed through this thick speech that Roosevelt had in his breast pocket and through a glasses case before it entered his body in a dangerous position. Roosevelt, bleeding, persisted, though. He stood up and he gave his speech while he was bleeding, saying it's going to take more than a bullet to stop a bull moose. So that did not bring him down. He actually, however, lived with that bullet in his chest the rest of his life. It was never safe to remove it. But let's go all the way back here to, of course, the big guy himself, George Washington. George Washington, he had so many incredible brushes with disaster that it is truly miraculous that he survived. I think one of the most outstanding incidents was when Washington was only 23 years old during the French and Indian War. Now, this was 20 years before the American Revolution. And there was a great battle here in which George Washington and his men were ambushed by a large group of French and Indians. I believe this happened July 9th, 1755. When they came under fire, many of these men were slaughtered. About 714 men were slaughtered. Eventually, everybody retreated. But at the end of the battle, George Washington was the only officer who had not been shot down. He was still on his horse right there on the front lines, riding around, commanding and fighting. He actually wrote a letter to his family after the battle, and he explained that when the battle was over, he had taken off his jacket and found four bullet holes through the jacket. Okay, not a single bullet had touched him. But four bullets had passed through his jacket, and several horses had been shot out from under him, but he had not been harmed. And he himself wrote, quote, "By all the powerful dispensations of Providence, I have been protected beyond all human probability or expectation." And he went on to acknowledge that he believed God's hand was upon him and God had protected him and kept him through that battle. And you may have heard throughout the years that there are stories about George Washington having been visited by angelic beings at very crucial times in this enormous struggle, because, of course, there was no reason that a ragtag group of underfunded and often disorganized colonists should have been able to organize and defeat what was then the most powerful military in the world, the British. And so there's a story. Some people debate the truth of this story. It's called Washington's Vision. And this was first published, apparently, in 1859 as reminiscences of a 99-year-old man named Anthony Sherman, who was supposedly present with George Washington's army at Valley Forge during the winter of 1777 and had overheard Washington tell an officer that an angel had revealed a prophetic vision of America to him. And the whole story is a bit lengthy, but I will just give you some of the high notes, if you will. Says here, okay, quote, Washington's talking to his men. "One day, I remember well, the chilly winds whistled through the leafless trees. The sky was cloudless. The sun shone brightly. He remained alone in his quarters all afternoon. When he came out, I noticed his face was a shade paler than usual, and there seemed to be something on his mind of more than ordinary importance. Returning just after dusk, he dispatched an orderly to the quarters of the officer." And Washington actually went on to say, "I do not know whether it is due to the anxiety of my mind or what, but this afternoon, as I was preparing a dispatch, something seemed to disturb me. Looking up, I beheld, standing opposite me, a singularly beautiful being. So astonished was I, for I had given strict orders not to be disturbed, that it was some moments before I found language to inquire the cause of the visit. A second and third and even fourth time I did repeat my question, but received no answer from the mysterious visitor, except a slight raising of the eyes. By this time I felt strange sensations threading through me." And he says, "A new influence, and mysterious, was present. All I could do was gaze steadily at my unknown visitor. Gradually, the surrounding atmosphere became filled with sensations and grew luminous." We're going to take a break. When we come back, I will tell you what this mysterious visitor reportedly said to George Washington during this moment of immense stress. And we will continue digging into divine intervention in the history of the United States. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange.
When a call's derailed, a smile from a veil, do you think you can tell?
Dungeons deep and caverns old, the pines were roaring on the height, the winds were moaning in the night, the fire was red. Flames red, the trees like torches blazed with light.
ever put yourself in the place of the founders of this country pledging their fortunes, their families, their sacred honor? They didn't know that they were going to win. Every single one of them would have been lynched on sight. And there were a lot of people trying very hard to kill them. It's incredible that our founders were able to create this country. And when you go to Washington, D.C., and you visit the monuments, and you read those words that had been etched from those documents, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution, they did have a noble vision in mind. And yes, it took a long time for many elements of that vision to be fully realized. They were flawed, just like we all are, flawed humans. But the world is a better place than it was then. And you can either have a pessimistic point of view and say, oh, the world's going to hell in a handbasket. But to me, if you compare what has happened 100 years by 100 years, collectively, humankind is becoming better. And the United States, at very least through freedom of expression, tries to promote that. You know, the very fact that I can speak to all of you right now, relatively uncensored, is a pretty big deal. And that is still not possible in a lot of countries around the world. I'm Joshua P. Warren. This is Speaking of Strange. In this hour, we're talking about the idea that maybe the United States made it and succeeded against so many challenges and obstacles and odds because there was some divine intervention. And maybe divine's not the right word for it. Maybe that conjures up too much of a religious connotation. In fact, when Thomas Jefferson was penning the Declaration of Independence, at first he put, "We hold these truths to be sacred," et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it was Benjamin Franklin who said, you know, that word sacred smacks of the pulpit a bit much. Why don't we change it to self-evident? Because that was a term that was often used in scientific language back then. We hold these truths to be self-evident. Regardless of what the influence was, there was a sense that something greater was happening, which is why "In God We Trust," however you want to interpret that, is emblazoned in our most influential places, not least of which being our money. Well, George Washington, according to some, had sort of divine visions. And there are people who will say, well, this was just made up after the fact. This is fiction. But this particular report about him having an angelic encounter comes to us from 1859, reminiscences of a 99-year-old man who supposedly was with George Washington's army at Valley Forge. And to sort of continue, so here is Washington by himself, and he spent a lot of time on his knees praying. And it's been said the only time anybody ever witnessed him crying was when he found out that he'd been betrayed by Benedict Arnold. But, you know, Washington lost family members, he lost some of his kids and that sort of thing. He was no stranger to pain. And here he is, according to this story, he's by himself, he's preparing dispatches, and suddenly a figure appears. And at first he's confused because he says, hey, I want to be left alone. And then it says, a new influence, mysterious, potent, irresistible, took possession. All I could do was gaze steadily, vacantly, at my unknown visitor. Gradually, the surrounding atmosphere seemed to become filled with sensations and grew luminous. Everything about me seemed to rarefy. I began to feel as one dying, or rather to experience the sensations which I have sometimes imagined accompany disillusion. I was only conscious of gazing fixedly, vacantly at my companion. Presently I heard a voice saying, "Son of the Republic, look and learn." While at the same time my visitor extended an arm eastwardly. I now beheld a heavy vapor at some distance, rising fold upon fold. This gradually dissipated, and I looked out upon a strange scene. Before me lay spread out in one vast plain all the countries of the world, Europe, Asia, Africa, and America. I saw rolling and tossing between Europe and America the billows of the Atlantic, and between Asia and America lay the Pacific. And then this goes on to say that the visitor explains to him that America is destined to become this new world, this world of freedom, this union of ideas and peoples. And it's quite lengthy. You can find this whole thing if you're interested on the internet. But it's interesting to me also that when you think about George Washington's own brushes with death, and you read these stories about his perhaps angelic encounters, well, now, if you go to the U.S. Capitol building and you gaze up at the breathtaking dome in the rotunda, you will find a painting called The Apotheosis of Washington. And in this painting, George Washington is literally deified. He is sitting there more or less in heaven with angelic beings around him and being glorified as some kind of a deity. Now, whether or not Washington, the man himself, would have appreciated that, I kind of doubt it, because by all accounts, he was very humble. They wanted to call him King George Washington, and he said, "We just got rid of one King George. We don't need another one." And, you know, he was unanimously voted in as the first president. I think he set the tone for what the country was supposed to be, and he did so humbly, but he also did so with some faith. And he was also a Freemason, of course, a very proud Freemason. And I'm sure seen pictures of him wearing his apron and whatnot. And one of the base requirements to be a Freemason is you have to believe in a power greater than humans. You know, this idea that there is some divine inspiration, it goes even beyond what has happened to individuals, though. And if you've ever read anything about the War of 1812, you will find one of the very best examples of this. Of course, the United States won the American Revolution and then was still in a very confused, weakened, disorganized state for many, many years thereafter. In the meantime, the British were over there in England just gritting their teeth, waiting for an opportune time to strike again, and they decided to seize that opportunity around the year 1812. They came back, attacked the United States once again, and once the British were in Washington, D.C., they lit the White House on fire. Our president at that time, James Madison, got on a horse and went riding off in terror, screaming to everybody, "Clear out," telling everybody to run. So here the British were burning the White House. And by the way, they did that after they sat down in the White House and had a nice big feast. Okay, then they burned it down. This fire spread. The War Department building was on fire. The State Department building, the Treasury Department building. This was spreading to private buildings. All of Washington, D.C. was going up in flames. The Capitol building was on fire. The original Library of Congress was destroyed. And this fire burned all day. It burned overnight. And on August 25th, as fires still raged, suddenly, amazingly, out of the blue, a massive storm hit Washington. The driving rain immediately extinguished most of the fires. But more importantly, it started overturning and sinking British ships, battering them terribly. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll tell you a little bit more about this miraculous storm that came in and was the turning point in the War of 1812, removing the British from here. But following this trend, this topic, I also want to move into some of the ideas about separating the idea of state and religion and how that was highly exemplified by one of our forefathers. It's a special 4th of July edition brought to you by Wright's Coin Shop. And you can call Wright's Coin Shop, write this down, 828-298-5402, 828-298-5402. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Stick around for the rest of the story on Speaking of Strange. Next weekend, be proud that you can listen to a program like this. You can get in your car and you can drive wherever you want to right now without having to ask anybody with the government about it. Don't take for granted the freedoms that we have here, and that's what you should pause and focus on. And I know a lot of people who came to the United States, couldn't speak English, didn't have any money, and now they're very happy. They're doing very well for themselves, even though it's a tough time. This country has always gone through tough periods of time, but the American experiment, as they called it, continues to work, and it does so against all odds. That's what we're talking about on this special 4th of July edition of Speaking of Strange. I am Joshua P. Warren. Tonight's program is presented by Wright's Coin Shop. And you can call Shelley right there at 828-298-5402. And you can also find a link at speakingofstrange.com, as well as a link to the Haunted Asheville Ghost Tours. And if you're looking for something fun to do next weekend, our ghost tours are going to be – well, they're already getting packed out. So go to hauntedasheville.com right now and buy your ticket. You can buy it online. And we have limited space. So I was talking before the break about the burning of Washington, D.C. during the War of 1812, when the British were coming in, and it looked like everything that the Americans had fought for was lost. I mean, you know, everybody had retreated. The president was gone. The White House was burning. The Capitol building was burning. They just didn't have the means to defend the capital of this country. The Brits, they figured if they just sat around, bided their time, they had the long-standing old world power, they'd have an opportunity to come back and finish things and get the country back after the revolution, and it looked like they were winning, and then out of the blue, this extremely rare, unlikely storm, the likes of which we've never seen in our lifetimes, hit Washington, D.C. The storm was so fierce, it tore buildings apart, literally lifting them off their foundations. The wind uprooted trees and knocked men to the ground. A number of houses and shelters collapsed, killing British soldiers. One British officer reported seeing cannons lifted off the ground and thrown through the air. Redcoats that were out in the streets of Washington were actually forced to lie down prostrate in the mud. Based on the firsthand accounts, weather historians generally agree that the storm that struck Washington on August 25th of 1814 sparked one or more tornadoes. There were guys trying to cling to each other. Their ships were being turned over and destroyed. All the fires were extinguished. As the storm began to subside, one of the British officers in command of the invasion finally emerged from his shelter and said to one of the ladies there, an inhabitant of Washington, "Great God, madam, is this the kind of storm to which you're accustomed to in this infernal country?" And she responded, "No, sir, this is a special interposition of Providence to drive our enemies from this city." So that's true, okay? There's no doubt that happened. Everybody agrees. All the historians say this amazing incident occurred and saved Washington, D.C. Nobody back then could control the weather but God himself, right? Nowadays, who knows? We've talked about weather manipulation with the HARP project and Oregon cloud busters and technologies out there now so that people can play around with the weather. But back then, that was, you know, one in a billion chance, I guess, of that happening. So there's no doubt the hurricane and tornadoes that struck Washington that day, they did more to save the Capitol than the United States Army ever did. And the British limped back onto their remaining ships, and that was pretty much the end of it. And from there, the United States was done with the British threat. I guess even then, you know, the monarchy, they realized, we're fighting something bigger than a bunch of poor country bumpkins over there in this rugged land. And now we see how history's played out since then. And yet something I find really interesting lies within the last great work of one of our greatest founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson. You know, Thomas Jefferson was not only the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, he was also not just the president, but he was a president who had this vision for expanding manifest destiny, sea to shining sea. And of course, again, there are a lot of Native Americans out there who suffered because of this expansion and this invasion. But that's always the story throughout history, isn't it? But Thomas Jefferson, who was right there in the midst of all of these high stress situations, who had his neck on the line just like the rest of them did, he lived to be an old man. He lived to be in his 80s. But the last thing that consumed his time and interest was creating something that we now know as the Jefferson Bible. And even though our money says "In God We Trust," and you'll find this all over official seals, even though God is never explicitly defined, and we know that there is this presumed separation of matters of church and state, Jefferson, toward the end of his life, decided to take a Bible, and he read the Bible a lot, even though he was quite a scholar and an inventor and an engineer and agriculturalist and whatnot. He got a Bible, and he sat down with a razor blade and glue, and he decided to edit his own version of the New Testament. It's formally titled The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth. And what he did basically was sit down with this razor, and he cut out all of the sections of the New Testament that mentions anything you might consider supernatural or miraculous, including sections of the four Gospels, which contain the resurrection and most of the other miracles and passages indicating Jesus was divine. When he was writing about this to one of his colleagues, he wrote, quote, "There will be found remaining the most sublime and benevolent code of morals which has ever been offered to man. I have performed this operation for my own use by cutting verse by verse out of the printed book and arranging the matter which is evidently his and which is as easily distinguishable as diamonds in a dunghill," end quote. Now, he personally never referred to his work as a Bible. This actually was put out at one point in a form called The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, being extracted from the account of his life and doctrines, etc. So in this version he created, Jesus is not even resurrected. The work ends with the words, quote, "Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new sepulcher, wherein was never man yet laid. There laid they Jesus, and rolled a great stone to the door of the sepulcher, and departed," end quote. So he did not make this version public himself. He said he found this project intensely personal and private, and in fact, every night he would sit down and he thereafter would read this version himself. Now, some people might look at that and say, how dare he? How blasphemous. He went in and cut out all the miracles and magic tricks. And that's what everybody has a tendency to believe their faith should be based on. I have a different point of view. I think this is a great testament to the fact that the power of those morals and those lessons and principles are strong enough that you don't even need all of the supernatural stuff. You don't need the miracles in order to find it worthwhile and worthy. And it is a wonderful complement to the teachings of Jesus and his belief in those teachings that he said, you don't need anything extraordinary and paranormal to understand the profound significance of why these are important words. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I'll share one last thought with you about divine intervention and the history of the United States of America as we move toward 4th of July 2014. Tonight's show is presented to you by Wright's Coin Shop. I'm Joshua P. Warren. It's the program where the unusual becomes usual. It's called Speaking of Strange.
Like me to entwine
Sound a little bit off to you? That's because this music that you've been listening to, this is the actual song. I mentioned this at the beginning of tonight's program. This is the song that provided the tune for the Star Spangled Banner, which, of course, was the product of the War of 1812. Francis Scott Key was watching the battle, I believe, at Fort McHenry, and he was inspired to write these lyrics, and eventually they were paired up with that tune. Why? Well, that song, as you just heard it, was it was a tune that just about everybody in the country already knew because it was a very popular drinking song. The reason is that they didn't have breathalyzer tests, and so a sobriety test, especially if they were trying to determine whether or not you had had too much to drink and whether or not you should be served more in a bar, was to require the patron to sing this song. They thought it had some kind of tricky lyrics, and so if you could sing that song properly, you would be served another drink. It's called the Anacreon song, and the title Anacreon refers to a Greek lyric poet who was known for his drinking songs. And so if there's any doubt about the connection between the United States and alcohol, well, not only were many of the revolutionary exercises thought up and planned in bars, but our actual national anthem is the theme of a drinking song. That said, we are in the final minutes of hour number two on tonight's Speaking of Strange. I am Joshua P. Warren. Mind you, next hour is going to be the Dark 30 hour when we dig into some of the more outrageous and controversial stuff, not for the kiddies, not for the easily offended. As we sort of wrap up this hour, you know, I have given you a number of examples of why that many people believe that the creation of the United States of America was the fulfillment of a prophecy that went back thousands of years, that perhaps was even alluded to in texts like the Bible, and that during the Middle Ages there was an enormous amount of conspiracy and secret societies that evolved imagining what it would take to create a nation where people could be free, or at least free compared to any other government that they had known, because you got to understand, prior to the United States of America, most of the history of the world consisted of monarchs and tyrants who controlled everything in a very stringent class system. There may have been a few scattered exceptions to that among the Greeks here and there, but for the most part, it was all about monarchies. And so the United States was a grand experiment. It still is. And when you go back and you look at these founders who laid their lives down and who may have even been protected by some divine power, that there was some spiritual prophecy they were fulfilling, the significance of the 4th of July is, I think, very nicely punctuated by the fact that two of the most influential people in the formation of this country, John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, both died on the same day, July 4th of 1826. And if you are not clear on the significance that John Adams had in the formation of this country, just go back and watch the HBO miniseries John Adams. It's probably my favorite miniseries of all time. And I'm not a big miniseries guy, but this one is amazing. It, to me, it seems about as realistic as you could get. I mean, not that I was there, not that I would know, but it feels very realistic to me of how all this kind of stuff probably played out in the 1700s. And, you know, John Adams played a crucial role as the first vice president and the second president, and then Thomas Jefferson as the third president. And but before the presidency, I mean, just getting this whole thing off the ground, they went through so many unbelievable scenarios that it really just it takes it over the top when you realize they both kind of hung in there, it seems like anyway, and died on the 4th of July, the very same 4th of July of 1826. So, again, bear all that in mind when you think about what this coming Friday means. July 4th, 2014, who would have ever thought that our country would have made it? I believe it's going to be 238 years. And considering that, you know, there are a lot of problems. There always have been. But we've always been able to work them out. We've always been able to solve them and persist. And if you travel around the world, you will see there's something very special about this place that we call home here in the United States. We're going to take a break. When we come back, get ready for the Dark 30 Hour. Tonight's program is presented to you by Wright's Coin Shop, 828-298-5402. I'm Joshua P. Warren. Stick around for the next hour if that sounds like your cup of tea here on Speaking of Strange.